This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk. But Dr. Lyle is not with us today. He's just a little swamped today. Dr. Hawk, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. All on my lonesome means we won't be talking about any stats today.
Thank God.
Well, I think it's incredibly valuable for a lot of people, but I have, in full disclosure, I've gotten a couple of emails from folks who've sent very nice emails saying, would it be possible to talk about something a little different this week? So we definitely, just by definition, since I am not a stats nerd at the same level that Dr. Lyle is, I have my aspirations, but you know, they're mere aspirations compared to his standing in that topic. Then yeah, we're not going to go quite in that domain.
Yeah, and I think we've done six shows on the stats. So if people are not familiar with your position on this whole coronavirus pandemic and Dr. Lyle's position, then I encourage them to go listen to those six shows. But I think that's sufficient to go over the current data so far. And if there's new data that comes out, I'm sure we'll go over it.
Yeah, definitely.
But and we were talking about this before we started the show, Dr. Hawk. That a lot of these, you know, numerical models and everything else is that they are based on certain assumptions. And so some people may have different assumptions that they prefer over others. And that will drive the end calculation anyway. So
yeah, of course. And we're still, you know, although it seems that we're living in this time warp where the months of March and April will never end, it's actually, we're very freshly into this whole thing, and everything's very new, and there are a lot of unknowns. And we've talked about some of these, and I won't belabor them at length now that I've promised you that we're not going to do a big COVID show, but there are a lot of potential genetic susceptibilities, potential environmental differences that are going to lead to really different fatality rates and really different, just different experiences of different people with different physiologies and different genetics experiencing this disease at different levels. And it could be much more fatal for some people than others. And we're just beginning to really understand what that looks like and why that might be. So until we triangulate on so much of that information, then a lot of this is just, it's going to remain really, really fluid for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I did get some emails as well. Some very positive emails. People are just really appreciative of your analysis on this, Dr. Hawk, and Dr. Lyle's analysis on this. And then we have some people who are just curious about more information, more data. So again, I encourage people who may not yet understand Dr. Lyle in your position to go back in those six episodes and try to piece together what the whole position is. Or if not, you know, that's, we've said as much as we can about it. So a funny comment that we, for the moment, yes. Yeah. By no means are we slamming the gavel down, but a funny comment from one of the listeners, last week, I got this, a couple of days ago, said in the last podcast, Dr. Lyle did a good job explaining how unlikely it will be for me to die from COVID-19. Unfortunately, since listening to the podcast, I've now become terrified of driving.
That's great. Yep. Yeah. Well, very fair point. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that actually did occur to me last week when he was winding out on it is that, you know, fear is not rational. I think we did talk about this a bit, and it, you know, my own, I think I've talked about it before. Like I hate flying. I have a very irrational fear of flying, and everybody knows it's safer to fly than it is to drive. Like a lot safer. But that doesn't stop me from being irrationally terrified to fly. Like that's just, just, it is what it is. And it's something that I can't, I'm not sufficiently independently wealthy to go through graded exposure therapy, which is really the solution for people that have big fear of flying, is that you essentially hire a pilot to take you up and land like 12 times in one day, which like boggles the mind, like terrifyingly. So, but even wow. if I had the resources,
what's this
to
called?
Do that,
something exposure therapy?
Yeah, graded. So, in that case, graded. It's okay. In that case, you're just kind of jumping into it and you're facing your fear straight out. But we've talked before with different people who have different, if you do, for example, have a fear of public speaking, you work your way into it with little smaller examples that would trigger the fear. So you give a toast at a, you know, maybe you're afraid of giving a toast at a wedding. So you just dial it back and you do smaller and smaller versions of the thing that's making you afraid. So you raise your hand in a staff meeting at work and you say something, and you kind of go through that process of the adrenaline, and you feel your heart racing and you feel the terror, and then you realize that you did that and it was very scary, but you actually survived and you didn't die. And it's fine. And so then you can escalate bit by bit as you move toward doing the thing that you're actually very afraid of. You're essentially teaching your nervous system that this thing that you have built up a bunch of terror around is not actually as fatal to you as you think it is, because you're approaching it very slowly.
So you're collecting data, would you say?
It's what?
Or would you say you're collecting data?
Yeah, you are. You're improving your information. So the fear is based on a distortion and a bad estimate and a bad inference of how likely how detrimental that process is likely to be to your survival and or reproduction. So you're correcting that by exposing yourself. So it's the same. It's exposure therapy for people who have symptoms of what we would call OCD or OCD-like behavior. So they can't leave the house without, you know, clicking the light switch 20 times. But if they don't do that and they just leave the house anyway, they discover that nothing terrible happened. The sky didn't fall. The ground didn't open up and swallow them whole. And so it's improving the calibration of the computer that's making that estimate as they realize that they can survive it.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you brought this up. Now, is 12 times a particular number, or is it just a number you just kind of mentioned?
Oh, with the light switch? I think I said 20, actually, didn't I? Or I didn't.
Oh, 20.
Yeah.
No, the pilot. I'm sorry, the pilot.
Oh, the pilot.
Going up in the airplane 12 times. Or is it just...
No, that was
I'm wondering if there's a certain number of times.
No. That was just...
going to depend on everybody.
That was based on, my idea of what a terrible, terrible day would look like.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, because once this pandemic starts to get, let me see how I put this, so I don't get a whole bunch of people accusing me of something. hopefully once the city and the local government starts to phase people back into away from a lockdown, there may still be people who are afraid to go out because they may be afraid of catching this thing. And so would this exposure therapy, where they go out to rent a movie at one of those vending machines, and then they go into a convenience store,
exactly.
And then they go into a grocery, So, and then they may be more relaxed going out.
Yeah. It's going to be an issue for a lot of people. Anybody who has that kind of circuitry in their nervous system that has been really latent and not triggered by their environment until now, you get into the situation where it's linked with innate disgust mechanisms, which are incredibly powerful. This is, we've developed really, really powerful aversion and disgust mechanisms in the human nervous system for very good reasons, to keep us from dying. And so everything that we've been through and everything we're going to continue to go through is just really enforcing and essentially classically conditioning disgust and aversion practices. And those are going to be really difficult to unwind for everybody, and particularly for certain personalities who are going to get really in a deep groove. And it's essentially just like any other conditioned behavior, all of the little cues of the wearing the mask and all of the things that are conveying to you that you're dealing with something that is really potentially very dangerous to your survival and or reproduction. You're going to be getting those reminders all over the place, even if it's not true or not as true or not statistically significant true in any kind of way that it should be really guiding your behavior if you're trying to optimize your life. So there's risk of with everything. Everything carries risk. Just like my fear of flying, you know, it doesn't benefit my life experience to have a lot of superstitious behavior and a lot of little conditioned practices associated with that that are trying to keep the fear at bay when they're actually just conditioning the whole process that is supporting the fear. So I discovered that actually when I flew recently and I was flying with a friend who was talking to me the whole time before takeoff and through takeoff, which is always the worst time for me. And it is for most people who are afraid of flying. I couldn't engage in all of my little superstitious behaviors. You know, I couldn't do all of the little things that I have been kind of conditioned to do that I was like, oh, I got to do this to keep the plane safe. And it was actually very liberating to not be able to do those things and to feel the rise in anxiety with like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do this. I have these like professional norms where I have to continue to have this conversation. And in the way that I'm talking about, that really kind of was a form of exposure therapy where it was like, oh, okay, well, I couldn't do all the little rituals and we're fine. So I guess I don't need the little rituals. And that's what people are going to be in a similar situation when we get later into the summer and, you know, we're on the downslope, presumably. I mean, data can always change and we can always be in a different situation. But if the current trajectories hold, if we're only seeing, you know, a minute number of new cases, people are going to have a really hard time letting go of this effectively what then becomes superstitious behaviors. They start off as adaptive, useful processes that are protecting you from some unseen menace. But it's very difficult to let those things go when they've been protecting you from the invisible, disgusting thing that they hold at bay, even in the face of new evidence.
Yeah, I guess people don't know it's bad luck to be superstitious.
At least I didn't say go up and down 13 times in one day. That would be obviously a terrible idea.
So this COVID thing, have you had any consults of people like giving up essentially or like just saying, oh, okay, I can take a vacation for, you know, 6 weeks or whatever it is?
Yeah, well, not only have I had consults with people who have sort of made that decision, but I think that that's a really prevailing source of wisdom in the mental health community. So I think a lot of people have been going to counselors and therapists and reading things online. And we've talked about this a little bit in previous shows as well, where, you know, there's a lot of memes floating around that say things like, you don't have to be productive right now. You don't have to do anything right now. You know, we're going through this very difficult collective trauma together. And this is not the time to ask much of yourself. And this is like a, you know, there's always a grain of truth to these things. And people are having very different experiences as they're dealing with whatever they're going through. So some people genuinely are experiencing a huge amount of upheaval and great financial distress and tremendous uncertainty in their lives. But a lot of other people are just in a moment of sustained inconvenience and maybe a little bit of discomfort, but, you know, ultimately just significant inconvenience. And they are hearing these kinds of recommendations, whether they're from mental health professionals or advice on Facebook or wherever it's coming from. And it's resonating with their desire, their sort of inherent energy conservation circuits that everybody has. It's what gets everybody in the pleasure trap and all of the other traps that we get into behind energy conservation. It taps into your desire to, oh, there's an excuse here that allows me to back away from competitive realities. And so all things equal, I should probably grab onto that because that is going to save me energy in the competitive scramble that is life. And people don't recognize that in that process, they're really sabotaging their own well-being a lot of the time. They're eroding their capacity to develop self-esteem, because self-esteem, the whole self-esteem process is coming from diligent effort toward progress on an important competitive goal. You can't really build self-esteem unless it's embedded in a larger system of progress toward an important goal. So if you've taken yourself away from the goal, if there is no goal other than, oh, we just have to survive this difficult time, as intuitive as that feels, and as much as it seems like the right thing to do, your genes are telling you this is a really valuable shortcut. This is a time that everybody agrees that we can, this is the ultimate Big Louie. I don't have to participate. I don't have to take a chance. I don't have to make life difficult for myself right now. You're really putting yourself in a situation where you're not giving your own nervous system and your internal audience any positive feedback about your progress in the world. And that's a big trap. And it's going to lead to feelings of helplessness and low self-efficacy and depression and more anxiety and all of the things that you were trying to avoid by avoiding competition to start with.
Yeah, that's I took a couple weeks off during a couple weeks ago with the patients here. And like for the first week, I was just like laying in bed, doing nothing, watching TV, Facebook. Then my internal audience was like, yeah, that doesn't feel good. You're not really doing shit. Like, yeah, you can't go out and, you know, work out, whatnot. But so
yeah.
I started like slowly cleaning things up in my garage. And like, I realized I hadn't really unpacked that much since I moved in here 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And like my garage was full of shit. So just like I took everything from the garage, put it in the living room, and it was just one at a time, just where does it go, and organized. And like all it took was maybe 6 days where I was just like, I wasn't completely done. I still am not, but I just felt like every room I walked into that was organized, I was like, I felt this pride, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. One of the metaphors we'll often use to explain kind of the difference between self-esteem and self-confidence for people, which can trip people up, is, you know, self-confidence, doesn't say anything about what you know about the process that got you to how presentable your house is for a party. So your house can be very presentable for a party, and you've got people coming over and everything looks fine, and you're confident that it's gonna look okay, and the boss's wife is gonna make a good assessment of your efforts, and everything is gonna be fine. So you have self-confidence about that situation, but your self-esteem could be in the toilet, because you know if they go in the bedroom and they look in the closet that everything's piled up and locked in there, and the kitchen drawers are full of crap, and everything's just like, you've just shoved it all under the proverbial carpet and under the bed, and you know that that's lurking, and that it's eroding your ability to enjoy the outcome. Where self-esteem is the fact that your house may not yet be exactly where you want it to be. It may still be pretty messy, like you're experiencing when you're pulling everything out from the garage, but you know that you spent that day doing really deep organizational work, and that you made really good progress, and you know that you made that progress. You know that you took 4 bags out to the dumpster, and you dealt with some stuff that you hadn't dealt with in a long time. So even though it may not be ready for the world yet, you're starting to nourish that little pilot light of pride that lives inside, that the internal audience is attuned to. So that's kind of the difference. It's the same thing when people are in trying to turn their health around, trying to, you know, adopt a healthy diet, lose weight. People may not see it on the outside yet, but when you have turned things around and you have made some amount of progress, and it's as you noticed with your cleaning efforts, it's usually somewhere between like 3 and 6 days of consistent effort, that it really awakens that feeling of pride, which is just another word for self-esteem. So when people are just withdrawing from competition entirely and, you know, using the time to do nothing with their lives and slacking off and all of these things that seem like a really good idea at the time, it's essentially the same kind of pleasure trap that you're getting from your nervous system when it wants to eat crappy food instead of healthy food. It's your nervous system screaming at you that this is the right choice because it's energy conservation. And we never want to waste time and energy in nature if we can help it. But ultimately your health and your happiness are being sabotaged in this process because you're you're taking away the one thing that is most responsible for driving human happiness, which is the self-esteem mechanism. And it's so, this has just been, it's ubiquitous in professional recommendations everywhere that I look. And it's been really amazing to watch the rhetoric unfold around what conventional wisdom this has become in such a short amount of time. This is not the time to ask much of yourself. Like, well, yeah, maybe not, but it's also probably not the time to opt out of life either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably somewhere in the middle, you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be context dependent like everything else is, but most people, if they're, you know, in a position to have internet and they're housed and they're listening to a podcast, then they're probably in a position where they should reflect on what meaningful progress they could be making toward improvements in their life. Which maybe the goalposts have changed as a result of all of this, but you're always in that process as a successful human. And if you're not in that process, then you're not going to be experiencing optimum happiness.
In my example, I actually started cleaning stuff in stuff myself. Do you think I would have had a similar feeling of pride if I, say, hired someone to go organize my garage? And I walked in and now everything's organized and I didn't do it myself, but I paid someone to do it.
You might have. I mean, as long as you were yourself up to something that was at the threshold of your capacity and your ability. So if you've got a really big goal to completely get your house organized, it's completely reasonable to outsource parts of that. And you don't necessarily have to do every little bit of the labor yourself, but you were still the author and the organizer of the whole enterprise. So you're not going to have much of a feeling of self-esteem if you are completely removed from it and just kind of check in and see what happens, because then it's not a goal that's you've got the confidence as a result of the whole process, but you didn't build up the esteem by watching yourself, having your internal audience watch you pack up those bags of garbage and take them out yourself. There's something very different about that.
Are there any specific tips that you would recommend people do if they are locked down in their home nowhere to go, little things they can do to improve their self-esteem or their confidence?
Yeah, well, they're probably the things that they were engaged in at some level before this all happened. So everybody's got, you know, some improvements that they can make in their life. There's some distance between where we are now and where we might be that would improve your standing in the competition that you're facing with romance or with friendship or with work. That's where it all lives in the realm of human motivation. So before COVID landed upon us, you were engaged, you had some self-reflection in the goals that you have for yourself relative to those domains of life and where you stood and kind of what you knew that you needed to do to improve your situation and make some progress toward improving your competitive station in life. And so I just don't want people suspending that behind this idea that, oh, okay, well, normal life no longer exists, and so therefore competition doesn't exist either. Competition still exists, and the feedback mechanisms of your happiness are still very dependent on your place in that game. It occurs to me, just another example with your question about the garage, it would be the same thing. You know, you wouldn't feel self-esteem if you had somebody, if I had hired somebody to write my dissertation for me. It's like, that's a slightly different example, because then there's a little bit of deception involved and then there's guilt and shame about that. But it's similar, where it's like, you know, you want to be in the position where you're doing the work and showing yourself that you've made the progress, that you've done you have put in the time to build something that didn't exist before and that it was challenging for you. That's where the feeling of pride is coming from, that you're right at that frontier of what you think that you're capable of. You're pretty sure that you're capable of it, and you're pretty sure that if you pull it off, it's going to lead to good results in your life and improve your competitive standing. If you then apply yourself really diligently to that process, and you create something that wasn't there before, you solve a problem that wasn't previously solved, that generates very authentic positive feedback for the self-esteem process. Whereas if you bypass it, you're going to pay a cost. You're going to feel guilty about it. At worst, you're going to feel really guilty about it. If you are bluffing or deceiving as part of the operation, and at best, you're just going to feel it's kind of an empty victory that you didn't really earn it. And therefore you don't.
Yeah. So Dr. Hawk, as far as organizing goes, we getting those esteem processes where you feel more confident and more higher self-esteem during this lockdown. Can you talk to us about the pleasure trap and the role that it may play during this particular time?
Yeah, well, it's very similar. So it's very, a lot of people are kind of giving themselves a free pass to, I'm so stressed out and my life has been so disrupted that it's really unreasonable to ask myself to have healthy behaviors, or no one could expect me to have healthy behaviors right now. And again, like with the other question, there is potentially some truth to that, especially when things first started out and people, couldn't get the staples that they're accustomed to shopping for, and were rearranging schedules and had kids at home when they don't normally have kids at home, and all of this upheaval that accompanied the early process here. But at this point, if you're still in that zone and you're still kind of telling yourself, when we return to normal, then I'll get back on my diet. Then I'll prioritize my health. Then you're falling into the same kind of trap that we were talking about before, where it's really you're not only potentially sabotaging your health, but you're really sabotaging your happiness. You're sabotaging your whole self-esteem process, which depends on you taking action against the difficult things in your life, the things that are blocking you from being successful competitively, that is the heart of what is going to unleash self-esteem for you. And for a lot of people, that is this particular struggle. So it's such a subtle thing, because this is another case where it feels like you're doing the right thing. Every cue that you're getting from your nervous system says, hey, you've got a built-in excuse here. Nobody's going to give you a hard time for gaining the quarantine 15. You're like, this is, everybody's in the same boat with you. You've got every excuse to relapse on crappy food, to relapse on alcohol, to put all of those goals that you've had for yourself and all of the progress that you may have made toward them aside while you just quote unquote survive this difficult thing. With the caveat that may have been true initially, while people were initially calibrating and figuring out where they stood. At this point, it's really important to take stock of where you are and what your goals are and how you can get yourself back in a situation where you're making meaningful progress toward those goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like. I was talking to a patient maybe a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, and I said, well, maybe now's the time where I don't know if I want to mention coffee, but coffee might be something, you can get rid of, because you're not really, you don't have to be at work. You don't have to be, at the meeting. You know what I mean?
Well, as a... As a well-known coffee addict, I actually tried that.
Right, that's why I didn't want to mention it. Because I was like, I don't want to even feel like I'm judging you.
No,
I don't care.
No, it's fine. It's fine, because I actually did. But this is part of the learning process, and this is important for people. So, I tried. I had exactly the same rationale where I thought, okay, well, this is actually a really good opportunity to try to put myself through this withdrawal process, and because I've quit coffee before and I know how crappy it is and how exhausted you are, which is always also, if you are a coffee addict and you want to quit, it's important to try to quit so you get that feedback. This is when we talk about relapse as part of recovery, this is what you're talking about, because every time I quit coffee, the withdrawal sucks so hard that it's like informing me of what a powerful drug caffeine is, because it has such a powerful compensatory response. And it's like, oh man, my adrenals have been absolutely walloped by this thing. And I can feel it with the withdrawal process and the compensatory reaction that my poor little nervous system has been gearing up for this onslaught of caffeine that I assault it with every day. So that's an important thing to experience, just so you viscerally really understand what you're up against. And then, of course, the process of actually quitting, if you want to quit, and experimenting with whether all of the wonderful things that you expect will happen in your life when you quit the substance that you're trying to quit, if those things actually come to pass, or if things are pretty much the same and you just miss caffeine, which is usually the case for me. So, like, I will quit and I'll go through withdrawal and it'll suck and I'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe this, the brutal drug that I've been putting in my system. Obviously, I need to stop. And then 2 weeks later, it's like, well, where are the cupcakes and rainbows that I was promised? Because, like, life is not that great and I just really miss coffee.
Right. And I think that this feels like it's a corollary towards, let's say someone's trying to get off the pleasure trap. It's like, well, we're in lockdown. We can't see any of our competitors. Mm-hmm. We can't see any of the objects of our affection anyway. So they're not watching. The only person who's watching is us. Yeah. That seems like the most difficult thing to do, is when the only person's watching is you.
Yes. Well, in some ways, yeah. But this week on his Well Your World show, Dylan Holmes actually talked about this. He did a plant rant, hashtag plant rant. So if people are not familiar, he go to YouTube and search for Well Your World. So Dylan Holmes, a friend of ours.
Oh, great guy.
Yes. Yes. Really, really great recipes. And he's also hashtag sauce boss. So we love Dylan, and you guys should all go buy his
dressings
sauces.
And sauces are delicious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But he talked about this week, where he actually was touching on a subject that we talk about a lot, which is the social pressure that people always claim to feel with being a big deterrent to being compliant with a plant-based lifestyle or with any healthy lifestyle. So people, one of the most common things and common questions that Dr. Lyle and I hear from people who are struggling with the pleasure trap is, oh, well, I can't do it because I have all this social pressure. I have to go out to restaurants. I can't be compliant at restaurants. And then I've got people at work that there's always tempting food. And then I've got all of this judgment from other people, blah, 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 blah. There are many different iterations of this. And Dylan was pointing out that, hey, it's just you. It's you and your food right now. Like, you're at home. You don't have social pressure. You don't have all of these compliance problems that people will often point to as an excuse for why they haven't been able to make progress. And so it's sort of like, well, what do you really value? What are you really trying to do? What do you really need to change? And as he was talking about too, it's you've got to have a pretty high degree of compliance with, particularly with a whole food plant-based approach, if you want to experience the benefits that ultimately shift the CB and make the whole thing worth it. So you don't actually know that it's worth it until you've done it fully enough for long enough that you've tipped the needle and you're feeling the feedback physically, mentally, emotionally. You're experiencing that there is, you maybe resolved some health issues. That's what's going to convince you that all of the trouble that you're going to change your diet and change your life is worth it. But unless you do it, it's like a little bit of a paradox. You have to do it wholesale, and you have to do it for a fairly decent amount of time. So, and most people talk themselves out of it long before they do it, get there often for these social reasons. So you don't currently have any of the social reasons because you don't have a social life. So, so that excuse is off the table, and then it's getting replaced with this, oh, well, you know, I'm home and it's chaotic, and I've got a lot of feelings that I need to medicate, and so I can't possibly. So it's just, we're just substituting one excuse with another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, Dr. Goldhammer tells people, well, do what I tell you for 50 years and then you can eat whatever you want.
Yeah. That's one of his.
And that just seems pretty unreasonable. Yeah. It's pretty unreasonable. I just ask people to go for 15 years and then they can. Then whatever,
very so. Good. Very yeah. good. Goldhammer light. Yeah. I mean, I fully appreciate, as someone who has done battle with the pleasure trap, Unlike Dr. Lyle, by the way, you know, like this is something that I understand very well. And it is very difficult it's basically any time that you are taken out of your standard life. So you get out of the groove that you're in, that's a very disruptive situation. And it forces your mind to come up with, to run a bunch of new cost benefit analyses on the best use of time and energy going forward. And that's a very taxing process. It's a very, you're depleting a finite amount of willpower. You're making cognitively exhausting decisions. And if you don't have a really beautifully dialed in environment that is going to ease those decisions in the right direction, then you're likely to make the wrong decisions. And so everybody to some degree or another has been disrupted. And so everybody's being taken out of their groove, and you're going to go hunt around for a dopamine drip on the lowest branch that you can find. And if it's in your house in the form of crappy vegan food or whatever kind of pleasure trap food is your drug of choice, you're going to get into it. It's just then a question of, okay, well, so that happened. Now what do we do? Now how do we squarely confront this reality and dial this back and get ourselves back into some kind of self-esteem stoking process where we can move forward with our lives rather than to continue justifying it as something that's beyond your control, because it's not beyond your control.
All right. Okay. So, yeah. So, Dr. Hawk, can you talk to us about how the different personalities might respond to being in lockdown in the face of the pleasure trap?
Oh, the pleasure trap specifically. Sure. I mean, yeah, you're going to watch the bell curves emerge in real time, particularly around conscientiousness and emotional instability. So those are the two things that are going to be most stressed by this kind of situation, where people with less conscientiousness are always going to struggle with compliance and need a particularly structured, rigorous environment where there's just no room for error if they are going to hope to be successful. And then unstable personalities, or people that are more toward the unstable end of the bell curve, they're just more prone to celebrating and medicating with food in general. And they're a little more that the allure of that, the little hit of dopamine that they're going to get from eating anything, really. I mean, dopamine is not just generated from eating crappy food. It's from any food. So eating carrot sticks is going to give you a little bit of dopamine. But if you've got anything in your house that's more exciting than that, and you've got a little bit of instability where you're trying to self-manage your anxiety a little bit, then that's going to be more of a problem for you. So those are the things that are going to be most highlighted by this particular kind of situation, and they're going to interact with other personality characteristics as well. People who are super open, particularly with regard to their food choices, which is not a way that my openness manifests. My openness is very happy with really boring food, but a lot of people who are very open on that end of the bell curve require a lot of variety, a lot of novelty. They want to go to a different restaurant every night. They're going to be extremely frustrated, and they're going to be, you know, getting regular orders from DoorDash instead of going out every night, because they're going to be seeking that variety, particularly if they're lower conscientious, and particularly if they're unstable. So these things are all iterative, and they all intersect with each other in all kinds of different ways. Super conscientious people. I've talked to people who, most people are struggling. Most people that I've talked to are struggling for all the reasons that we've talked about. But some of the HCNCs are actually just leaping into it as a great opportunity. So they're fasting, or they are, getting just really there. They're at home, and they really are taking advantage of the situation that they don't have coworkers and birthday parties and boxes of donuts in the conference room, and that they have complete control over their food environment. And so they're really having great success for the first time. So you do see different results that are following from different personality types. So it always goes back to, you know, where the advice hasn't really changed, which is know thyself, know what your personality really is and where your likely liabilities are with reference to this problem, and then alter your environment accordingly to compensate for whatever deficiencies you have in the personality realm. Well, now your environment has changed, and so maybe the equilibrium that you had and the environment that you had constructed that was really serving your personality and working for you, and you were making some progress, maybe that has been disrupted to the point where you now have to revisit that and think about, okay, well, given the new reality and the fact that I don't have as much control over my environment in the same way that I did, I have a spouse home, I have kids home, I can't pack a lunch and take it to work and have a lot of control over that, and so now I'm grazing all day. Like, all of these things have really changed the environment on people. So all that means is that you kind of have to go back to the drawing board and figure out where are the pitfalls, which are, you know, you've had several weeks now with which those pitfalls have surely become very obvious to everybody, and be really honest with yourself. Like, you know, is it your openness that is getting you back online and ordering food from different restaurants every night? Is it your conscientiousness that is not high enough, and so you're getting into the stash of junk food that your kids have? Whatever it is, there's got to be some kind of way that you can reverse engineer that environment and make it more protective for who it is that you are, and an opportunity for you to actually thrive and get back to making those progress on those goals, which is the whole key to self-esteem and pride and happiness, which is the whole point of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not to let me just take great pains, because I can see that being totally misinterpreted out of context. Not to say that the point of life is losing weight and being healthy and that you can't be happy without doing that. But if that is an important competitive goal for you, if this is something that you're really struggling with and that you have elevated as a competitive pursuit and rather than retreat from it, this is an important thing to stay engaged with and to try to continue to build a successful strategy to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Now the hypernormal stimuli, the foods, does that actually alter the motivation where people are like, well, actually now it's not so important because the food is so good?
Oh, well, I mean, that's just the pleasure trap.
That's the pleasure trap, right?
That's the pleasure trap. And also, I mean, almost everybody that I've been talking to for the past couple of weeks is deep, deep in the grips of some kind of conditioned cram or another. So, you know, new environments bring new equilibria, which bring new rituals. So people have kind of gotten into some new groove where they're getting into the same kind of junky food on a regular basis, some kind of really high calorie dense food. And now they've conditioned that process. So it's the condition cram is two parts. It's the sort of built in capacity and interest that humans have to get into rich food when it's available, because it's ancestrally very rare to find rich food. So you've got that. But then when you repeatedly have rich food night after night, it doesn't take very long. It only takes a few nights. You're teaching the nervous system, just like you teach your dog when you pick the keys up off the table, that it's time to go in the car and go for a car ride or go for a walk. You're making the association with the environmental cue and the behavior that, oh, now it's time to eat that rich food. It's time. This is when we get into the coconut ice cream or the granola or whatever it is that you have on hand that may be very biochemically totally fine for you, but you know, not absolute crap, but it's still a little too calorie rich. And once you build that association and you wear down that little conditioning groove, then you're in trouble, because that's when craving kicks in. Craving is just the compensatory response that your nervous system is mounting against the unnatural process of the cram. So all of the little stomach enzymes come online, you start to salivate, you start to anticipate that this is the time of night when we get into the chocolate. If you've done it for a couple of nights in a row, just like Pavlov's dogs. So the only way out of that conditioning process is to break it by white knuckling it and going through the withdrawal. And the withdrawal is riding out the compensatory response until your body finally realizes, it looks like the good stuff isn't coming. And it's not worth putting out all of this compensatory time and energy. I guess we better invest that elsewhere. So that usually takes between 3 and 5 days for people. So almost everybody that I've talked to, a big part of the trouble that they're in is that they're home, and so they're binge watching whatever they're binge watching on Netflix, and they're ordering a pizza from their favorite place, or they order groceries from Safeway and they get the same kind of vegan ice cream or whatever it is. There's like some kind of new set of food related rituals that have entered people's lives. And with those rituals, because it's super normal food, you get a condition cramp.
I would have expected that people without kids and are on lockdown, they're deemed a non-essential business, and therefore they have to stay home. I would have expected people in that position to have much less trouble with Pleasure Trap or any other type of goals, because now you can work quietly in your woodshed while nobody's watching and there's no distractions. Whereas people whose kids may have now they're forced to be at home while the person may be working from home, and so now they have way more distractions. I would expect them to have much more trouble with this Pleasure Trap or any other goals that they're dealing with. Whereas if people are locked down with the same situation, I wouldn't have expected them to have more problems with Pleasure Trap and everything else. But now, Dr. Hawk, that you explained the conventional recommendations, which is, oh, you've been through a lot, and this pandemic is ravaging everybody's emotions, and so therefore, you know, you don't have to be anxious about not competing and not, getting things straight.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all things equal, people who are, the more moving parts you have that have been disrupted, the harder this is going to be, because the more uncertainty you have and the more difficulty you're going to have kind of reconstructing that environmental equilibrium. So if you do have kids and you've got a spouse or you've got roommates or lots of you're cohabitating with different people and you're trying to find new ways of getting along and organizing your daily life, it's just more fatigue on the system. And it takes you further and further and further out of your groove. Where if you're a single person you've gone from getting up and going to work and coming home and watching TV by yourself and going to bed, and now the only thing that's changed is you don't go to work. You just still get up and then you still watch TV and go by yourself to bed. It's like there's fewer moving parts, there's less disruption, and so the sort of effort to reconstruct an environment that works for you and for your goals is it's a lower threshold. So for those people, all things equal, it is easier. But you know, of course, there's personality in the mix. And so if you're low conscientious and part of your routine was that you packed a lunch for, you know, you stopped by the store and you got the stuff that you needed for your salad and you prepped your salad a week in advance and then you packed your lunch for work, and this was all very much like structured, which it is for a lot of people, and that's all been thrown into the air and you don't have that routine to your day anymore, it's basically like you're in a permanent weekend. And it's a truism of the diet world that people do really well all week long and then it goes to hell on the weekend. And so now it's sort of, this is why, because you've lost the structure, you've lost the routine, you've lost the groove. And the more decisions that you're forcing yourself to make per day, the more times you're trying to count on your willpower to do the right thing, the more you're setting yourself up for failure, because that's a very limited resource, and we can't. You could just, the Pleasure Trap does not speak willpower. it's not a defense against it. The only defense against the Pleasure Trap is structural change and structural environmental protection. Moving away from the store that you're going to find yourself going to all the time, locking up your husband's treats so you don't get into it. You can't get sober working in a bar.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that the environment is the best defense against the Pleasure Trap.
It's the only defense. Yeah. And people will have, this is, you know, I've talked about this many times and I've lived this reality myself, where it's like you get confused because you feel like you've defeated it through the force of your willpower, and you're all proud of yourself and you think your willpower has got this locked in and you've finally gotten it together and you've figured it out and you're finally just sufficiently motivated and organized enough and your willpower's on point and you've got this. And so people get deluded and deceived into thinking that their willpower is a lot stronger than it is, but it is an illusion. And there happens to be some willpower present, but the willpower is not doing the hard work for you. The environment is. And so the more you're counting on willpower to affect change for you, the more you're setting yourself up for failure.
Absolutely wonderful. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for coming on solo.
Yeah, sure. Anytime. I apologize for the lack of math.
No, you don't have to apologize for that at all.
I'm sure.
But we know that, Dr. Hawk, you did a dissertation at Harvard, so there must have been some math you have to know to do that and to calculate all these experiments and data and put together a defense of this PhD in front of a group of other PhDs. Is that my accurate there?
Yes, that's very true. They do. They run you through quite the trial and make you take really terrible stats classes, and you do have to be able to, particularly in political science, which is basically the poor, ugly stepsister of economics, you have to be conversant enough to be able to read the literature and to analyze the findings. And big portions of political science are very statistically driven, particularly in American politics. And I have half a leg in comparative politics and half in American. So I've done my time. It's just not where I choose to live most of the time.
Well, wonderful. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll look forward to having you back next time.
Beautiful. Sounds good, Nate. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.